Today on Wings, Women After Disaster.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The 145th annual meeting of the American Public Health Association drew 12,000 people on the theme Climate Change and Public Health. One of the panels was entitled Women in Climate Change. I'm Melinda Tuhus. I attended the panel for Wings.
The risk from natural disaster is higher for women, but particularly for those with fewer resources.
Dr. Dorothy Riddle, PhD in clinical psychology. She has lived, worked, and taught in 86 countries. Her talk was entitled, Women as Natural Disasters' Unseen Victims.
In the United States, 56% of people living in poverty are women. 60% of poor children live in female-headed households. 12% of women 65 or older live in poverty, which is twice the rate of men. And many of these are responsible for children and grandchildren. Many women in the United States do not speak English, so in terms of any outreach during disaster, this has to be taken into account. Women are less likely to be prioritized for assistance. Emergency shelter, food, and water resource allocation may be focused on male heads of household. Doesn't always happen, but it happens often enough. Emergency resources may overlook the needs of infants as well as menstruating and breastfeeding women. Emergency medical services may overlook prenatal care, reproductive health, and sexual assault services. Emergency responders may dismiss women, especially older women, remember those 65 and older responsible for children and grandchildren, as unimportant. They may patronize women and not take their concerns seriously. They may disregard the consequences of women being widowed. They may overlook or participate in sexual violence and ignore human trafficking. I want to just underscore this. This is an issue that is not talked about very much, that when men feel under stress, one of the ways that they may feel they are entitled is to release that stress through sexual violence, sexual abuse. Women often face conflicting roles. And one is as decision maker for multiple generations regarding when to stay in place or evacuate, where to go when evacuating, and what to stock and take. So they're responsible for children, adults, and the older generation often. They have to find food and potable water with few financial resources. If you're living in Puerto Rico right now, this is a huge, huge issue. They have to find temporary and more permanent shelter. They have to arrange schooling for children. Oftentimes, children are in schools that provide at least one meal. So when they're out of school, they're not only losing education, they're losing food at the same time. They need to find work, and they need to file claims without access, oftentimes, to the documents that they need. Now, I just want to make an aside here. British Columbia, where I live right now, has had its worst wildfire season in years. The number of people displaced has been horrendous. The difference between what's happening in British Columbia and the United States, to me, is stark. If I am in British Columbia and I am displaced from my home, I go and I sign in with a shelter, a provincial agency, the Red Cross, whatever, and I'm handed $600. I don't apply to FEMA. I am given cash as well as a place to stay and everything. If I'm out of my home for 2 weeks, I'm given another $600 in recognition that people have immediate needs that need to be taken care of. If you're living in Puerto Rico right now, you're supposed to be applying online or by phone. Neither services are available. You know, it's nuts, pardon me. Okay, so here's two other roles. Ongoing caregiving. So care for children while standing online for resources. Ensuring that children are safe, that they're not playing in or drinking contaminated water. Think of all those pictures that we had in Florida and in for Hurricane Harvey. Find ways to care for infants and small children safely. Ensure health services for all family members, including medications and necessary ongoing care. And remember, these are women that have economic responsibilities as well. Keep children safe from sexual abuse. Acquire caregiving services to free themselves for recovery activities. And then there is also self-care, right? Getting support for frustration, stress, exhaustion. We've heard about PTSD.
You're listening to Dr. Dorothy Riddle, a clinical psychologist, who spoke at the panel on women and climate change at the American Public Health Association Conference 2017.
So in terms of emergency preparedness strategies, when you go back to your community, someone is responsible for emergency preparedness. Who are making those decisions? How many women of color are involved in those decisions? Find out. Conduct and maintain a community skills inventory to avoid on-site sex role stereotyping, because women will be slanted into the support economic roles that are traditionally seen as female. They may be excellent electricians or carpenters or whatever, but they may not be considered for those roles. Identify resources for victims of violence ahead of time. Designate organizations to provide infant and child care at least 15 hours a day. Otherwise, the women can't look for work, they can't get food, they can't stand online. Provide elder care 24 hours a day. Figure out who's going to do this and who is going to provide patrols to prevent rape and human trafficking. We may think that human trafficking doesn't happen in the United States. It is alive and well here. Prepare multilingual, multimodal signs and materials. Now, there's a particular risk for women who are survivors of domestic violence. They typically have fewer resources of their own, and they need to shelter undetected, which is often overlooked, because they're often put in with their family members, or in order to apply, they have to have access to documents that the abuser has in their care. It's unsafe for them to stay with families where the abuser can find them, and they're vulnerable to search at mass evacuation shelters. We need to plan ahead of time for a safe shelter capacity. Usual shelters are often decimated or breached due to physical damage or loss of power. They need shelter capacity outside of the disaster area with transportation to it. So in other words, links being made with other communities where there are domestic violence services. And there needs to be a plan for adequate legal assistance to ensure legal aid and enforcement of protective orders, which often becomes a low priority when other things seem to be much more important. Then in terms of general acute responses, we need to provide stipends to each adult, not just to males, because oftentimes the male is assumed to be the head of household in terms of applications. Women need to be engaged as managers of food distribution. There's research from all around the world that if women are in charge, they make sure that children get fed. If men are in charge, they make sure that the men get fed. Ensure adequate nutrition for women and girls who have different nutritional needs. Set up pre- and postnatal health care, as well as sanitary delivery facilities and treatment for rape survivors. And establish safe options for women and girls being abused. Now, here are some common abuse scenarios that we have to plan around. Males feeling powerless and frustrated are likely to rape and sexually abuse women and children. These statistics are often not reported in the newspapers. You have to dig for them. They physically abuse children. The rate of traumatic brain injury to children after an environmental disaster skyrockets because of this. Women may be forced to engage with domestic violence perpetrators, and unable to financially support those for whom they are caregivers. They're vulnerable to pressure into sexual exploitation as the only way of financially supporting those that they're responsible for. And children who are unsupervised while women are standing online and doing other things are vulnerable to human trafficking. They simply disappear. In order to protect against abuse in emergency shelters, we need to make sure that these are well lit and all areas are under observation, that there are at least 2 adults in any area where there are children to avoid abuse to the children. Be sure that all staff and volunteers undergo background checks and disaster relief training, including how to spot signs of sexual abuse and assault, and ensure law enforcement presence in shelters. Now, this is a problem when we have persons who are not documented. They are afraid. So on the one hand, we need law enforcement to protect against abuse. On the other hand, we need no law enforcement visibility for people to feel safe in the shelters. It's an issue that communities need to discuss and resolve ahead of time. And finally, we need to provide ongoing care for infants, children, the elderly, and those with disabilities, and continue to protect girls and women from sexual abuse during the recovery, not just the immediate emergency. This can stretch on for years afterwards. We need to have gender-neutral job boards. Women need to be in paid rebuilding activities, and women need to have immediate control over economic resources. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Dorothy Riddle, a clinical psychologist who focuses on the burdens of women as caretakers, speaking at the panel on women and climate change at the American Public Health Association annual meeting 2017. A second speaker on the panel, Dr. Gloria Giordano, has a PhD in nursing and teaches at Louisiana State University in New Orleans. She noted that all care systems were disrupted during the hurricane aftermath, including access to birth control, adequate nutrition, and prenatal care.
You're listening to WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service.
The historical roots of both climate change and patriarchy include the rampant extraction and exploitation of both human and natural resources, institutionalized in our trade, manufacturing, and finance policies that benefit corporations and industrialized nations as opposed to really looking at human rights for all.
Jacqueline Patterson is director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Her presentation was entitled Race and Gender Spell Double Jeopardy in Disasters for Women of Color.
76,000 coal miners have died of black lung disease since 1968, while year after year the National Mining Association fights against the very regulations that would have protected those workers from coal mine dust so that they can continue to maximize profits without any regard to human rights and human life at all. And transitioning to natural gas has its own perils, as we all know, in terms of fracking. And all of these practices disproportionately impact women. Air pollution, water pollution, soil contamination all gets into our bodies through what comes out of the smokestacks, what gets into our waterways through runoff or releases, and then also what gets into our soil, whether it's via acid rain or through runoff or otherwise. And this all impacts our bodies in different ways, and particularly women's bodies, as what comes out of smokestacks, particularly coal plants and oil refineries and so forth, includes endocrine disruptors, which has an impact on our reproductive systems. And so as we begin to talk about some specifics, I want to really root us in not just kind of the statistics and the general stories, but also who is being impacted. This is a woman named Annie who lived in North Carolina, and she was doing her own independent health survey where she was going around in her neighborhood, speaking to her neighbors and making notations about illnesses that she was finding in her community. And on that notepad, you see the list of names, and next to them, you might see a little notation, and those are D's for people who over time were deceased. as she was doing the survey. And when I was doing this presentation 3 months after I met her in North Carolina, when I showed her picture, there was kind of a rumble in the crowd. And then I asked what was going on, and they said that just a couple of weeks before that, she herself had passed away. And she told me when she was talking to me that she was also feeling the health impacts of this exposure to coal ash in her community. And when her husband walked in, she kind of started talking lower because her husband actually worked for the company that ran the coal-fired power plant in the community. So we see physical health impacts, but even relationship and mental health impacts of living in those situations and being a defender of human rights in those contexts. This image tells a story from the Four Corners region out in New Mexico, where this family talks about the coal-fired power plant behind them being one of four coal-fired power plants within 50-mile radius of where they live. And as you see, it's all women in the picture except for the little boy, and that is because all when the coal plants came in, they came with the promise of jobs, but they actually didn't come with the number of jobs that they promised, and they came with people in those jobs. So the men are actually not even living in the home. They're having to work in other states because they're the only places where they can get jobs, and they only get to come home every few months. Meanwhile, these women in this community are living in the shadows of these smokestacks and ingesting those fumes, and they're holding a picture of someone in their family who had passed away. And they talk about the other people in their family who have various health impacts from ingesting the chemicals from those smokestacks. And then they also talk about the woman to our far left who is pregnant, and we know that mercury is one of the things that comes out of these smokestacks, and it is tied to birth defects. And as I said before, the endocrine disruptors are also a challenge as well. So we just start to see how disproportionately women are impacted. In the aftermath of the disaster that happened around the Flint water crisis, female-headed households were significantly impacted by not having the mobility to be able to move, being the caretakers for their family, particularly single women-headed households. And this is one family of a woman and three kids, and they're relying on 151 bottles of water per day to just do their daily activities for life. And there was story after story that was similar in terms of physical burdens as well as the mental health burdens that women face in these contexts. People may have heard of man camps that happen in North Dakota and South Dakota, camps where people come together for the extraction industry, the oil and gas industry, and it's all men living in those places. What often doesn't get told is the story of the women, largely indigenous women, largely women of color, who are disappeared in those situations and who face sexual assault in those situations often as well. And so this is another piece along the climate change continuum, both the drivers and the impacts that disproportionately impacts women. And so as we talk about the results of climate change, whether it's sea level rise that's displacing folks across coastal regions, places like the Pinellas County in Florida, Thibodaux, Louisiana, the Kivalina in Alaska are all facing imminent displacement within 20 years because of sea level rise. And already one community, the Ile de Jean Charles Band of the Biloxi Chinamaca Choctaw tribe, was displaced because of sea level rise. In the Gullah Geechee Nation, which is a female-led indigenous group in St. Helena Island in South Carolina, that is facing imminent displacement and, in the meantime, significant disruption from sea level rise, storm surge, etc. And as we see shifts in agricultural yields, we know that women in the United States and across the world are more likely to be food insecure, and particularly female-headed households are more likely to be food insecure. For women around the country, that actually has a deadly impact because women are facing extreme increases in domestic violence because agriculture is seen as the role of women in some societies, and it is resulting in violence against women that they aren't able to fulfill their roles because of the shifts in agricultural yields. One of the more chilling stories that I've heard in doing this work was working in South Africa, where I was doing a focus group, and the women were saying that they need access to female-controlled condoms because now girls who were previously walking 5 kilometers are now walking 10 kilometers to get water. And they said that they would like for those girls to be wearing those female condoms for all of those walks back and forth because that's the likelihood that they'll be sexually assaulted in that walk to get water because that's the context in which they're living. And so these are the kind of stories that really help us to understand those intersections and the depths of those intersections and the fact that we can't just kind of address the intersections, but we have to address the underpinnings of sexism, racism, and so forth that proliferates these circumstances. And so when we see communities where they're more likely to access foods from a corner store high in sugars and sodium and preservatives than foods that are rich in antioxidants, vitamins, nutrients, and we again see female-headed households are more likely to be in those kind of circumstances, we see these chronic illnesses that are disproportionately affecting women, and particularly women of color who have compounding challenges. So as we talk about disasters, whether it's people who are more vulnerable because of poor housing stock, or not having homeowners insurance, or it's the aftermath of disasters and disproportionate allocation of resources, we see where race and gender also come into play as well, and the fact that after disasters there's a significant uptick in violence against women. We've seen that after Hurricane Katrina, we saw that after the BP oil drilling disaster, we saw that after the earthquake in Gujarat, the earthquake in Haiti, and the tsunami. And so time and time again, it's proven to be true that sexual violence has an increase because of the insecurity, and domestic violence has an increase because of the stress of the disaster aftermath.
You're listening to Jacqueline Patterson, director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program, speaking on the panel on women and climate change at the American Public Health Association annual meeting, November 6, 2017.
And so as we continue to think about the systemic underpinnings, even as we think about who's in power and making decisions, I took this picture after one of the flood of tornadoes that went through in the South, and was struck by the folks who were on the stage who were in local government, who were FEMA, who were Red Cross, who were the people who had the resources, who were making decisions, who had the services to offer, across the board, white American, and then also disproportionately men. And then when I looked at who was lined up at the mic asking the questions, needing the information, needing the resources, down to a person, women, and down to a person, African-American. And that image really told the story for me in terms of some of these dynamics. And so and when we were in the UN climate talks in Poland, we all came together around a Gender Justice Day, recognizing all of these intersections of the disproportionate impact of violence. Violence against women and other gender-based discrimination in the context of climate change. So this is actually three women who, the woman in the middle is from Gulfport, Mississippi, and the women on the side are from the Philippines, and they're all survivors of disaster. At that very moment when we were standing there, the super typhoon Haiyan was ravaging Tacloman, where these two women were from, and the woman in the middle is one of the people who evacuated with just literally what they could fit in their car from Katrina after the disaster, and has since evacuated from other disasters as well. And so as we talk about the way that we have more punitive ways of thinking and talking about immigration in this current political context, but yet, as we know, the U.S. is 5% of the population, of the global population, but 25% of the emissions that drive climate change. So we have to really take responsibility for the fact that people's lands are becoming uninhabitable, whether it's Barbuda, which first time in over 300 years doesn't have anyone living on the island of Barbuda. And again, it's because of our actions as this nation that's taking up way more than its share of the global emissions that drive climate change. And so when people are coming here, it's not because they want to take our riches or take from us in some kind of predatory fashion. It's that people are just trying to survive. And so when we need to think about immigration and sanctuary and refuge in that context, as opposed to this kind of threatened punitive context around immigration. And so we see the struggles around gender justice, climate justice, and immigration rights is inextricably connected. This quote from Warsan Shiri, a Kenyan-born Somali poet, says it all. You have to understand that no one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. So this, once we were doing a gathering of women around climate change called From Katrina to Copenhagen, and it was in advance of the UN climate talks in Copenhagen. And this is another kind of touching moment in my work, where this woman, Tracy Coons, who's with the Louisiana Bayou Keepers, talked about how she could find common ground with, at that time, it was the time when the Somali pirates were in the news, and she said she could find common ground with the Somali pirates. She could find common ground with someone who would feel that level of desperation because they're relying on the water for their livelihood, and their livelihood is under threat. And so she said, she talks about that feeling of helpless desperation as she tries to think about the future for her children as someone who relies on the water for her existence and for her to be able to feed her family. So we talked about water a little bit before. So even in the context of water shutoffs, water scarcity that's growing, again, we see where this is a disproportionate gendered issue. So as we move towards thinking about solutions, we see how, again, with this intersection of gender justice, racial justice, immigration rights, and so forth, we have to always be intersectional in our thinking as we are intersectional in these impacts. And so so looking at some of the ways that we've gotten to where we are, some of these influences of certain entities on our political context need to certainly be addressed. We have certain entities that are influencing the media and so forth and so on. And then even fueling this notion of climate denial, even though the evidence of it is staring us right in the face. And so there we have this kind of displacement of our democracy, and therefore our votes. Votes don't count as much as they should when we have people buying elections and buying elected officials. So we have, when we see kind of this context of decision makers, we know, you know, why we are where we are, as people are trying to control the status quo by maintaining the very systems that I talked about in the first place in terms of trade, manufacturing, finance, policies, and so forth. And we need to think about making sure that we do have a representational government that truly represents our interests. And so as we talk about transition, we're talking about moving away from an extractive economy that's rooted in domination, exploitation, rampant extraction, to one that's a living economy that really uplifts all rights for all people, that's rooted in regeneration and regenerative systems, and that's really rooted in deep democracy. And we see that people need to be in the leadership of that transition. This is another person who's going to be on our panel later, at the closing remarks. It's Kimberly Wasserman with the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, who's been leading on some excellent transition at work in Chicago. Jahan Giron with the Black Mesa Water Coalition, who's been working on not water work as well as energy work in terms of making the transition. Grid Alternatives, which has a focus on getting women in leadership in energy, where we're grossly underrepresented in energy and in STEM in general, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. We're facilitating processes to make sure that we're moving away from these kind of patriarchal systems of, you know, again, white male-led and corporate-led decision-making and structures, to having community leadership as we make our transition. This is one with the Flint, now the replacement of the Flint mayor back in power, away from the emergency financial manager whose only responsibility was to balance the books, and now we're back with someone who's actually looking at human rights as well as the finances of the community. Moving, pushing forward on voting rights and seeing the intersection between voting rights and these very challenges that we are facing. And just uplifting the women's leadership of different women from across the country who are doing this work. So I am wrapping up because I have like 10 seconds left. But as we talk about re-envisioning communities, we really are talking about making sure that communities are in the lead on their own self-determination, and they're making decisions for themselves. And they're a part of this shift that we need to make away from a society that burns in order to create energy, that buries waste and develops landfills that are toxic, that have these disaster systems that disproportionately impact women and other groups in various ways. And so as we move forward, we know that we're all interdependent, just as all these systems are interdependent and all these rights are inextricably connected, that we as people are all inextricably connected, and we can't do this without each other. So thank you very much.
That was Jacqueline Patterson, Director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program, speaking at the panel on women and climate change at the American Public Health Association annual meeting in Atlanta on November 6, 2017. For Wings, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
Email wings@wings.org to hear any Wings program again. Thank you to Wings supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.